there was something Mother Kadamba said to which I would like to add just as a little footnote, and that was the remark about having to have good health in order to live this vocation. That is true in most monasteries, but one of the most remarkable monasteries I've ever seen was one where they take only people who are not in good health. They are called Sisters of Christ Crucified. I was in the one, visited two of their houses, one near Philadelphia and one in Rhode Island. And they take only people who are in some way ailing and sick. Some of them with something like diabetes or so, where they are quite, can be quite active, just need constant care. But others with very serious handicaps like blind and deaf, mute, and so forth. And they also support themselves by their own work. In this case, I don't know what the different houses do. They have houses all over the world. I know in Holland and I think in Korea. In Philadelphia, they supported themselves by processing slides for hospitals. They had trained their sisters to process these slides and file the slides and so forth, microscopic slides. And it was remarkable because it was certainly the most joyful community that I've ever seen. They were just totally joyful, free in the sense of freedom's just another word for nothing left to lose. And there were continuous accidents. I mean, little accidents. You can imagine with this orderly monastic life, there's continuously something that goes wrong. One was reading the chant in Braille, and she got the wrong page, and she started the wrong antiphon to sing, and nobody else could find it. This sort of thing. They would spill the soup, and there were several in wheelchairs, and even though this had gone on for a long time, but they would fall over one another, swerving. And every time a little accident like that appeared, everybody was bursting out laughing, even in choir. In chapel, they were all laughing. So it's a most inspiring memory that I have, and shows that monastic life is not even restricted to the healthy, physically healthy. My natural approach is not very autobiographic, so I'm very grateful that Mother Kadamba did what she did. But I will try to be as autobiographic as I can, and I have no hesitation to answer any questions that you will ask. It's not that, it's just not my style. So I would like to clarify some terms that might be rather important, particularly from our Catholic monastic context. And I will try to do it in a partly autobiographical way. The question is, first of all, how does one get to monastic life? I mean, how does one get there from scratch, so to say? We were always talking about when you have a vocation or so, but I mean just from scratch. How does anybody that you can think of get to monastic life? And I think there are first of all, there is a basic experience, a basic human experience involved, and a couple of decisions. And that is what I would like to explore with you. The basic human experience is an awareness of belonging. That is the simplest way in which I can say it, sort of in everyday language. And all human beings have that somewhere and sometime, as an awareness of limitless belonging. And the reason why I can be so sure that every human being has it at some time is that as embryos we can be sure that we have that sense. And we know now that our prenatal consciousness is continued into our postnatal consciousness, and so we know there is a continuity, and therefore we can say with a great assurance that all of us at some time had this sense of limitless belonging, which is bliss, equals bliss. Limitless belonging equals bliss. Now, through our studies of prenatal life, we also know that some people have even prenatal remembrances of being unwanted children, attempted abortion and things like that, even prenatal ones. Many people, unfortunately, many people in our culture would say, this sense of limitless belonging was never really given to me. I was deprived of that, even as a small child, even as a child. Well, when somebody makes this kind of statement, they do not make it as a cool observation of facts, but they do it with terrible anguish and existential grief. And that shows us that there is a great deal more involved than just an observation. It shows us that we all know, even if it has not been mediated to us, even if it hasn't been given to us in a fully developed form, we know that it is, so to say, our birthright. See? As human beings, this sense of limitless belonging is our birthright. That is what we have in common with all human beings at our deepest level. And that, I would claim, and then, of course, many people, most people, fortunately, have that experience also often many times, often in very dramatic ways, in other cases just as a sort of groundswell in the general awareness throughout their life. And it's what psychologists call peak experiences. It's a sense of limitless belonging, that this total bliss. And that is at the same time the basic religious experience. That's how I understand religion, as the, well, many different interpretations of this world, but they all have something to do with our relatedness to ultimate reality, our relatedness to all there is, relatedness to ourselves, our relatedness to all there is, the whole cosmos, and to the source of all that exists. So this relatedness is again a sense of belonging, and that lies at the root of everything, and especially at the root of religion. Now, there is where this is the basic experience that I talked about. Now, that's where the first decision comes in, because you can accept or repress and reject that awareness and that experience. We are capable of rejecting it. I don't know whether you can reject it forever. I very much doubt that. I'm not pessimistic about it. I do not think that very many people reject it and repress it, even though it might look so. I think they find some other ways of dealing with it. But at any rate, the possibility of rejecting it is given, and so we have now a decision. Either you reject it or you accept it. And the acceptance of it means now your religious life. That's what your religious life is. Long before we come to any religion, this or that different religion, it's just a person who lives a religious life, lives out of that awareness of ultimate belonging. That applies to all the organized religions, but that also applies to a person's private religion. It always boils down to translating that awareness of limitless belonging into some way of understanding it. And if that particular avenue of our intellect dealing with that awareness is further developed, we get eventually religious doctrine. Religious doctrine, no matter how long it develops and no matter how complex it is always a reflection, an intellectual reflection on our deepest sense of belonging. That's where it comes from eventually. Then it also, every religion, and therefore also our private religion, if we have no other, entails a moral commitment to this belonging, some commitment of the will to this belonging. So some saying, yes, I want to live the way one lives when one belongs to other people. I want to express that. We are all one big, in a highly developed form, you'd say this whole universe is one big household, earth household, as Gary Snyder calls it. We are one big family with the plants and the animals, and we want to live in a way in which that expresses that. Well, that would be a very high stage of morality. So morality comes in here. And then also, it's not only our intellect, our will, but also our emotion, and the emotions want to celebrate this awareness of belonging. And that's how you get ritual. And every ritual in any religion in the world, if you trace it back long enough, you will find eventually it is a celebration of our belonging. It's sometimes truncated and sometimes distorted and sometimes one has almost forgotten what it ever meant. But when you go back to the root, ritual is a celebration of belonging and ultimately of limitless belonging. So those would be now the religious, the aspects of religion, of general religiousness. And now we come to a further decision. We have already accepted this religiousness either in our private religion or in that traditional religion that we either were born into or that our relatives had or that somehow or other we went to school with. We have somehow accepted in general terms. And now we can either leave it at that and have no further interest in it. That's my religion, and maybe even practice it a little bit, but that's it. Or we can take it radically serious. And when we take it radically serious, we enter into what in our Catholic tradition we call religious life. Now, I have used religious life in a different sense, because just as all of us have an intellectual life and an emotional life and a biological life and so on, so we also have a religious life, and that somehow the living out of that deep awareness of belonging. But religious life in the narrow sense is now a commitment to this, to religion. Now that is where we are now in the realm of religion. And I had this experience very clearly. I cannot pinpoint it sort of by date or so, but I can. I do remember seeing, like in school, so grade school or so, seeing other children, classmates or so, who were conventionally religious, and I felt a real interest, a real drawing to being radically religious. This was important. That's where it was. That's what it was all about. So, whatever interests us, we want to be radical about. And that interested me. That was what made life interesting and worthwhile. So I can very well remember that even in grade school I would distinguish myself, not in any way comparing or even not reflecting too much about it. But I was going to take that thing seriously, you see, this religious thing. And I could clearly see that others were not that interested in it. So that was a decision again. Okay, now when you go long enough with taking it radically serious, then you will commit yourself in some way formally to it. At least this is the setup that we have now in the church. Tomorrow we'll talk about the future of monastic life, and there are other possibilities. But anyway, the way it is now, you commit yourself, you make profession. You see, you make the religious life your profession. That's a very strange thing, you know, when you think what we think of professionals. You see? But the religious, all those religious that usually you see going around with veils or some other strange cloth, or others that you can't so distinguish, but you know they are sisters or brothers or monks or whatever, they have made profession of religious life. They've made a profession of religious life. What does that mean? Does it mean they are better than others? Well, unfortunately, nowadays in our society, we know that professionals are not always better than amateurs, anything but. And we even know that that amateurs have in many ways a higher standard. You see, at the Olympic Games, only amateur sports people are admitted. That means they have a higher standard there. They don't do it for money. So, and that is a sad thing, but we might as well face it. The religious who are professional religious, among other things, have also financial advantages. See? So that is another connection with the professionals. We have financial advantages. The moment you make profession in a religious life, what did you call it? Ordination, I think you call it being ordained. Or so was that the term you used in mind? Well, that more or less corresponds. And I suppose it's the same there. But at any rate, I'm just talking about our tradition. The moment you make profession of religious life in any community, you're pretty sure that you are never going to be destitute. Never. You may work with the poor, you may exert yourself to the limit, you may waste your life away in service of others, like the sisters or brothers of Mother Teresa or something like that. But when you get sick, somebody will take care of you. When you need to travel somewhere, somebody will give you the money to travel. You will not likely starve to death. This is, doesn't normally happen, see? So there's something there that we have to frankly face. But anyway, you are now a professional religious, and now there is again a choice to be made there. That's my third and last one. And that is between being an apostolic religious, sometimes you call them active and contemplative, but I hardly want to mention these terms because I think they are not applicable and not correct and misleading. What is a good terminology is to say there are then the apostolic religious. Apostolos means one who is sent out. So they go out into the world and try to serve the world in one way or the other. And then there are the monastics, and they create a little environment in which they try to change the world. And now we have here two different forms of transforming your environment. Okay? And when you look back now, you recognize that all these various steps were really steps and decisions in to what degree and in what form do you allow your deepest religious awareness to transform your environment. Step by step by step. You reject it and allow convention to form your environment, or you accept it and then you take it, but don't take it very seriously. Then you take it very seriously. Then again, you have the choice of either going out and trying to help transform the environment of the world, or you draw a wall around it, that's the cloister wall, and you try to change at least that little place inside and make it in every detail conform to your deepest convictions. In other words, make it an environment that is helpful for mindfulness, for being mindful of this deep belonging. That sense of belonging, make it a place for gratefulness, because that's how this mindfulness expresses itself. And there has been a continuous struggle or sort of bickering throughout the centuries between the apostolic religious and the monastic religious. And the apostolic will always say, well, what are you doing in there? We are really trying to serve the world. What are you doing there behind your walls, you see? And then the monastics look over the wall and say, well, what are you doing out there? We don't see any changes. Have you ever... In here, it may not be so glorious, but at least we have achieved some changes. This environment looks different. When you come in here, there's something else going on here than in the rest of the world. And what we change in there is everything. And when you come to any halfway decent monastery, I think of any tradition, I have never been to any monastery of any tradition, now this is East or West, anywhere. Everywhere you see that. It is a transformed environment. Time and place are transformed there. Just the fact that we were referring to these bells, they are signals, but they are also music. They call you to whatever it is time to be done. We have had these beautiful bells here now. In the conventional world, you are not doing things when it is time to do. You do them when you feel like it, or when you absolutely have to. But neither is true in the monastery. In the monastery, do it not because you feel like it, nor because you absolutely have to, because you don't have to do absolutely anything. You can go home. You can go out. You do it because you like to do things when it is time. And that is why the whole schedule is not arbitrary, but it is adjusted to the cosmic flow of things. You see? During those night hours that you mentioned, those marvelous 2.5 hours, when it is still dark most of the year, but there is something that you can do at that time for which it is time, namely to meditate, to read, to steep yourself into meditation, which no other time is quite as good. So your bells will remind you of that. And so throughout the day, whenever it is time, the bell rings. And you attune yourself to that. And that's what you learn. In obedience, whenever the bell rings, you don't even cross your T's or dot your I's. You go. And that can be a very strict discipline. But it's not for the sake of the discipline. It's not something like a trick that you teach a dog or something like that. It is that you learn interiorly to always listen for what it is time for. And then you might be out in an environment outside where there's no bells and nothing reminds you of it. And if you have learned what you were supposed to learn there, then you will be attuned and you will be listening to what is it time for. And that's really the essential of monastic obedience, not to doing what somebody else tells you. That is a method for learning that virtue, but to be attuned to what it is time for and to do it at that time. And then with regard to place, to realize it's also transformed in a monastery because partly by stripping things to their essentials, and partly by other means, for instance, by making them beautiful, but that is most of the time one and the same. When you strip things to their essentials, you see the beauty of them. It's not by decorating them that they become beautiful, but by stripping them. So by a confrontation with reality, that is the decisive thing. That's in the monastic environment. Ideally, you are confronted with reality, and that makes that helps you to be more mindful and more grateful thereby, because mindfulness means that you are so fully aware of what is happening at the present moment that you realize that it is our gift, that this is a given moment, and you are overwhelmed with gratefulness. And that is that's, to my mind, the answer to what makes for the joy in monastic life. The more mindful you become, the more grateful you become, and it is gratefulness that makes you happy. It's not happiness that makes you grateful, because there are many people who have everything to be happy, but are not grateful, and therefore they are not really happy. And other people who have lots of trouble, but are grateful for what they have got, and they are very happy. So the key is in our own hands, in this gratefulness, mindfulness. And now I thought sort of a little conclusion and a little more autobiographical. I'll answer some of the things, ask myself, for what am I particularly happy, or what makes me so happy? What are the joys in my monastic life? See? And one of the great joys in my particular monastic life, because I was more exposed to that than most other monks are, is recognizing other monks when you see them. And this is a good occasion here. This is a tremendous joy to just take one look and you recognize one another for what you are. See, had a very striking experience in this respect. When I first began to be interested in other monastic traditions, and I was very slow, that was not my doing so much, but it was rather I was being pushed to interest myself in other religious traditions. But when I started doing that, I met a Buddhist monk. And he had just come from Japan to New York, where I was, and eventually, friends arranged for us to meet, and immediately it clicked. I mean, we were both a bit apprehensive, and that was in the early days, it was in the 60s still, and we thought, mid-60s, we thought, well, what would we talk with one another, these monastic dialogues, they were not yet sort of the accepted thing. So we met by the Metropolitan Museum of Art, and we thought we'd just look at art things and oriental art, and we have something to talk about. But we never went into the museum. We just sat on a bench there in the park, and we talked for hours of all the things that were really important to us. And then he invited me to come down to his zendo. It was a Zen monk. I didn't want to do it. I was perfectly happy in my monastery. I didn't want to go to the center, but I thought it was a great idea because I saw what it could affect in this bridge building. So I always suggested that somebody else should do it. And every time I suggested, my abbot said, yes, that's a great idea, but he never did anything about it. And then quite some time later, I suggested, why don't you invite that monk up to the monastery? And so they invited him, and he came, and he stayed with us 2 or 3 days and gave a number of talks, and the monks had opportunities to ask him questions and so forth. And they asked him all these abstract theological questions, and he gave all these Zen answers. It was a total disaster. I was hardly opening my mouth, and I thought, that's the end of this project. And after he had gone home, the whole community unanimously said, we didn't understand what he was talking about, but we watched him, and the way he walks and the way he eats and the way he sits is totally convincing. This is a monk, and you can go. And I had to go. You know? 2 weeks later, I was down there, and I spent 3 years with the Zen monks. You see? But it was totally just monk recognizing monk. And that is a very, very joyful experience. That's one of my joys of monastic life. Then, of course, study and meditation. Just imagine to have... in every monastery, most monasteries that I've come to, most monks complain of not having enough time for studies. But then you realize that even so, you have so much more than you would have in any other walk of life. And that is just incredible. As I said, these hours in the early morning or so. And also the communal studies, and that you go on studying all your life. And that you have in many monasteries, like in my own, you have table reading. So while you are eating, somebody is reading to you. Day after day after day. Imagine the scores of books that you read in a couple of years. And they have all been read by the community together. Everybody has heard them. And you can share about them. And when you can talk about something worthwhile that you've read. And if the books are well chosen, they are worthwhile. So this intellectual attitude, I like it very much. It impresses me very much. Then manual labor, that's the other half of it. Where do you have so such a rich intellectual life, and at the same time you can really dig in the ground and work with your hands? And I expected to do so. Every monk is really expected, well, not necessarily in the garden, but to do at least some maintenance work and get their hands dirty and work with our hands. And that's... And I was very happy to hear that the Buddhist monks do that too. I got at one point the impression they weren't working. They just weren't working to earn a living, but they're just as much working with their hands. So that manual labor and the study, they balance one another. And then, of course, I did house cleaning once in my earlier monastic year, happier monastic years, for more than a year. I did every day house cleaning in the monastery. And I still look back on it as one of the happiest times, because if you do it long enough, you know every corner, and you are always again caressing that same corner. And the dustpan, when you hit it with the broom, just the music that it makes, and the dust flying when the sun shines in, and the dust flies up. And so, I mean, you have to get into it, and it takes a while. But it is really just that's heaven. Can be heaven if you do it willingly. And then, of course, worship in community. You know? We often make the mistake of expecting from communal worship more than communal worship gives us. There are certain things that your meditation alone can give you, and your worship by yourself can give you, that you will never get in community. I always compare it with cooking. When you cook for yourself, you can spice it exactly the way you want it, and so forth. Where you have community cooking, you have to eat what is sort of an average taste. And that is also true with community worship. But then think of what you... just recently I was in Rome, in San Gregorio, which is a monastery that belongs to these Camaldolese monks with whom I am now. That used to be the villa of St. Gregory's family, St. Gregory the Great, who was a Roman patrician in the 6th century. This same house, so he turned his house into a monastery. At that time you didn't build monasteries, you just had a house and you invited others and you lived there as a monk. In that same house, for 1500 years now, the monks have been singing. And so we go in the morning, the bell rings, and you go there and you chant, and you have behind you 1500 years of monks have been chanting in that very same place, the very same psalms. It's just spine-chilling to me. It's just incredible. It's just incredible. And that's a real joy, the joy of that tradition. Now, the tradition has also its flaws, and you are sometimes very embarrassed about the tradition, like you are sometimes embarrassed about your family traditions. But you have to... I look at this moment at the good things. Well, one more, that is the joy of the cell that you have, you see. Of course, not in all monastic communities you have a cell, a place to yourself. But to have this place where you go in and you know you're really by yourself, you're really alone, you will not be disturbed. How many people have that? And so, again, it's over and over this gratitude that not only, as Pema said, is the monastic life easier than the householder's life so far, but it is also, it has so many of those gifts that it's just overwhelming. And my last one, it may be difficult for you to understand, or maybe not. It's when guests come, of course, continuously retreatants and guests coming to the monastery, and every time they leave, I say to myself, wait a moment, they are leaving and I can stay? You mean I can really stay? I can stay in this place? These people come, they come for 3 days or they come for a week, or, and they are just overjoyed for having been in this environment for 3 days. And then they go and we stay and we stay and we stay. It must be something like that when you own a ski hut and all these guests come. Well, anyway, I hope this gives you some idea of my joys in my monastic life.
Would you like to take a few minutes?
If we have a little time, yes, I'm always very happy about the question. Yes. Yes. well, from your laughter, I suppose that most of you are familiar with this disastrous letter. But late last year, for those who are not familiar, the Vatican published a letter that was, it's important to remember that it was not addressed to the church, really. To the people in the church. It was addressed to the bishops, and it was supposedly a letter about Christian prayer, and because today Christian prayer is coming in contact with Eastern forms of prayer and meditation, there was some reference also to Eastern meditation. And it was on the surface friendly, but underneath hostile. And many Christians today, many Christians, Catholics, it was just for Catholics, were deeply hurt and offended by this letter, because it didn't stay with the bishops. It, of course, got around through the newspapers and so forth. So very many people were deeply offended and angered and so forth. Now, I think the most decisive aspect is that this is the institutional church in its worst sense. We need some institutions. Life creates structures, so we need some structure. But the structures never create life, so the institutions also don't create life. They just self-perpetuate themselves. And so you have to renew and reform them every so often. But there are positive aspects and negative aspects to institution. Well, this was the institution in its worst, in its worst aspects, panicking in the face of spirituality. See? Because those are the two poles. The institution at its best is the husk that protects the life of spirituality. That's at its best. At its worst, it is some ironclad structure that does not allow the life of spirituality to unfold itself. And therefore, there is, even at its best, there is always a certain tension between the heart of a church and its skeleton or something like that, its structures. There is always a certain tension. But it can be a life-giving tension. It doesn't have to become a polarizing, destructive polarization, you see. Well, in this case, at least this is my interpretation, it is the institution at its worst getting scared of the spirituality. And that is in itself sad, but it's a good sign, because it shows that the institution is sort of breathing its last in this form. Whenever there is a clash between institution and spirituality, don't worry. This is a foregone conclusion who is going to win. Because even if they wipe it out, as has on occasion, it springs up somewhere else. The institutions come and go. They break down sooner or later and are continuously revised and reformed. The spirituality, that's life, that cannot be destroyed. So from that point of view, it is even a good sign. It has also had gotten some very good responses and occasioned some very good responses, and not even anticipating that it would come up here, although I could have, I brought along a letter from Father B. Griffiths, whom many of you know. He's a Benedictine monk who has for several decades now been living in India in an ashram, and lives like a Hindu monk, and has done very much for communicating understanding between monastic groups, and is highly respected in the whole church. And he wrote a letter to the National Catholic Reporter on this Vatican letter not very long ago, and I brought it here, so I think I will leave it around somewhere. Please don't take it away, but I will put it here behind me, and those of you who want, it's just a few paragraphs, those of you who want to read it might want to look at it. It's, if, as far as I know, it's the best that has been written about it in response. And his main point is that the letter totally misrepresents Christian prayer and Christian spirituality. See? It has nothing to do with, long before we come to any unfavorable remarks about Eastern spirituality, it totally misunderstands Christian spirituality. And he quotes several passages and refutes them very nicely. So, well, maybe we are ready. Thank you.
And at this point, since we've been sitting for a while, what I'd like to suggest is that we take 20 or 25 minutes for